I don't know how many municipalities have a resiliency division, but Highland Park does. The team is there for people who were impacted by the July 4th, 2022 mass shooting at the Independence Day parade. But the city, its residents, and its mayor have shown great resiliency, and they are moving forward. Well, this weekend, Mayor Nancy Rotering talks about healing, closure, and a whole lot more. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. Nancy Rotering has been the mayor of Highland Park since 2011. Before that, she was a city council member. She's also an attorney, and I'm sure she never envisioned nor would want to the events that would be what her city would, at least in these recent days, be best known for. But the mayor and the city are a lot more than a place that endured a senseless tragedy. And we're going to talk about all of that in this half hour. We're speaking via Zoom, and Mayor Nancy Rotering, it's good to see you again.
Great to see you, Craig. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we have to start with the latest chapter, I guess, in the aftermath of the shooting that left 7 people dead and many wounded. Robert Cremo III, the gunman, was sentenced to 7 consecutive life sentences and more time for the others hurt or wounded. And I would think the most important part, Mayor Rotering, was that victims and others impacted got to speak.
Absolutely. The 2 days of the sentencing hearing in Waukegan really were 2 of the most intense days I've ever experienced. And we collectively as a group finally got to hear the full story. Each of us had our moments, our stories, our individual experiences. But then to hear it all literally from the start in 2017 when he started planning this, to its conclusion with his sentencing was the turning of a page, I think, for a lot of people. Obviously, for several, the immense loss will never go away of family members who won't be with them to celebrate and to be building new family memories. And for so many people, there were life-changing wounds and injuries. And then for thousands more, there also have been life-changing traumas. So I think for so many of us, it was an important 2 days for us to be together as a community as we continue on this journey forward.
Well, you know, people like to talk about closure when there's tragedy and violence. I don't know if it's possible to get what we traditionally think of as closure on horrors of that magnitude, but what do you get?
You definitely don't get closure, as far as I can tell. And it certainly varies from person to person. People came to that parade with different life experiences and left that parade with different experiences themselves. The closure piece, I think, is more a matter of we don't want this event to define Highland Park. We don't want to be known as that city that had that shooting on that day at that event. We are an incredible community of caring, supportive people. We saw that in the immediate aftermath, and we've continued to see that now as we approach 3 years hence. And I think it's important, again, we use the word journey intentionally. It's because for so many people, that's what this is. And, you know, as we approach July 4th this year, we're already looking at where do we move from the morning to activity, to action, to community building, to starting our steps forward again as a community? We obviously had the parade for the first time last year. It was absolutely heartbreaking as people were crying on the sidelines because we want that normalcy. We want, especially for our kids, those new memories for them to have that are positive, that they look back fondly. It was interesting. Yesterday, I was talking to John Gray's mom. John is with Blackstone, and his mother still lives in town. And John and Mindy, his wife, generously gave the city $1 million towards a place of remembrance in the immediate aftermath of the shooting. But his mom and John have frequently talked about how, for all of his great achievements, he's always that kid from Highland Park who has great memories of decorating his bike and being in the parade. That's what we want to get back to. I just hosted a group of third graders. We have third graders come through City Hall and we do mock city council meetings, and then we have Ask the Mayor Anything. And a year or two ago, one of the third graders asked me, will we ever get to celebrate the 4th of July? I had to fight tears in that moment. And to me, it's so important that we as a community obviously never forget. And that's why we are carefully building this place of remembrance. But we also want to give our children back that pride, that joy, and that sense of community that everybody carries with them. It's interesting. In the immediate aftermath, I heard from people across this country, famous alums from the high school that we're so proud of, just all coming back and saying, but those are some of my favorite memories, was that parade. So I think we're moving forward slowly but surely, again with a different lens, but always looking towards this great community and the resilience we saw, not just in the immediate aftermath, but now as we continue forward.
And I know that as we look ahead to this year's parade, there are things that are different now. I think I'm not sure if the drones were active for the last year's parade, but you can talk about first, what are the things that should help make people feel safe and confident so that they can focus on the festivities and how you expect it to go, because that was the first parade last year. This may be, now that there's been a sentencing, is it celebratory? May be the wrong word, but maybe it should be the right word.
You know, it's interesting. We every year we choose a theme for the parade, and the parade that was impacted was the first parade after the pandemic. And so we chose the theme was Who's Your Superhero? Community. Because this community had been so strong and so supportive of one another coming through and out of the pandemic. So that was what that theme was. This year, our theme is Dream Team, again, because of what a great team we all make together. And it's also a way for kids to get involved if they want to celebrate the Cubs, the White Sox, the Bears, the Bulls, whatever. But it's also, again, for us to kind of drive home the message that we are a team. And this team is moving forward. The parade route has changed. The first year, it was really important for us to, in my view, reclaim that route to say evil and violence doesn't take away this special place in the heart of our community. And so many people, you know, we had 5,000 people walking with us. 5,000 more watched on Zoom. As we crossed through the intersection that's referred to as the hot zone, a lot of people felt a sense of catharsis. However, we also recognize for a lot of people, it still can be difficult to go through that intersection or to be in that plaza, which is again right in the heart of our downtown. So we've changed our route. We can now march through a different part of our central business district without giving people that trigger, that momentary feeling of what happened here. The drone question is interesting. The drones during our parade had not been permitted under law. That was a civil liberties action that people felt it would chill speech. But in the aftermath of what happened, we pushed forward for that legislation and asked, is there a way to thread this needle? Is there a way for us to keep people safe from folks who might have evil intentions up on rooftops? It just gives more eyes on a group event that so many people now are edgy, understandably. I mean, these mass shootings are happening hundreds of times a year. People need to have that sense of if someone's coming for me with evil, we're doing everything we can to mitigate their opportunity. So that law came actually in the aftermath of the shooting. And we will be using those drones again to make sure that people feel safe. It's important for people to recognize we totally support the First Amendment, gathering, free speech, peaceful assembly. There's a lot of that going on these days. We're not doing it to get anybody in trouble. We're doing it to keep people safe. And there are very strict regulations around the use of those drones. So that'll be very helpful.
And you've touched on it already, but I want to ask if how you're approaching what the city does to remember what happened, to remember the victims. But I also know that you've been really looking at different ways of doing things as opposed to just a standard memorial.
Right. And it's important to note we're using the words place of remembrance intentionally because we are remembering those seven precious lives that have been lost, but we are also remembering the incredibly awful injuries that 48 people suffered. And we're also remembering the trauma that thousands of families endured. And we're also remembering and celebrating the resilience of this community and how we came together to support one another again in the immediate aftermath. It's important to note, and this is something that I want to come back to, Craig. We had 1,200 people a day coming for trauma-informed mental health care services. And we had hundreds of professionals in this community who gave free time to help their neighbors work through the immediate trauma. What I want to come back to is that's something that every community needs to have available because these shootings are happening with such regularity. They may be once in a lifetime for some communities. They are a regular occurrence for other communities. And the trauma that comes from living with that kind of violence needs to be addressed, needs to be able to get the help to help those people move forward. And so, to me, one of the important lessons that we've all learned as a community hit by a mass shooting is that it looks completely different in some ways for every community, but it looks completely the same for all communities. And what I mean by that is, America's mayors know it's not a matter of if, but when a mass shooting is coming to their community. That's just a reality that people have had to face. But by the same token, we need to recognize the horrible, devastating impact that this kind of violence and trauma can not only have on people's mental health and physical safety, but on their quality of life, on their ability to have a local economy, on their ability to get to school safely, to be able to just live in their home safely. It's so pervasive and so unnecessary. So I think it's important, and you know me, I could go on for days about what we need from Congress, and I will at some point. But for now, it's about that community need and making sure those resources are available. My current state of mind is if we're not getting rid of the guns, then we need to at least give communities the resources to move forward from these violent traumas that they're experiencing. When a tornado comes through, heaven help those communities impacted last night, but we know this, when tornadoes come through, when a train derails, the government is there immediately to help those communities get back up on their feet. But for whatever reason, they turned a blind eye on the devastating public safety, public health, mental health impacts of these mass violence events. We need to do more to mitigate the causes. But in the meantime, we also need to provide those resources to those communities so they can move forward from these events.
And I do absolutely want to talk about the gun issue, but I also preface that by pointing out I think that even if your community hasn't been hit by violence, such violence, when I go to events now and as I cover them as a reporter, people are looking around. They are watchful. They are nervous. They,
Right.
you know, if you hear yelling, people yelling over there, it might be a bunch of kids having fun, or it might be people who want to know what's going on over there. So
Absolutely.
there's a tension. That exists even if it hasn't happened yet.
Absolutely. And my understanding, I think it's the Giffords organization, Gabby Giffords organization has noted, or maybe it was Pew, somebody did a survey and found that two-thirds of Americans have changed their behavior around concerns of possible gun violence impacting them, whether it's avoiding events, looking for second exits at the movie theater, being hypervigilant in certain circumstances. And it's unnecessary. Again, it's unnecessary. We know that our peer nations don't live this way. And when they come here, or I teach at Northwestern, I have students from other countries, and they've said to me, people have asked them, why would you go to the United States for school when it's such a violent place? And we've become, I fear, kind of inured to some extent. And we shouldn't be. This should not be acceptable. There's an interesting quote somebody wrote after July 4th, 2022. And she said, it's not just the impact and loss of life, but it's the impact on quality of life. And it really is true. So I agree with you. We're always kind of looking, where's that second exit?
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Dellamore, and I'm talking with Highland Park Mayor Nancy Rodering. And I think people may forget that even before the 2022 tragedy, Highland Park was focused, under your leadership, focused on the issue of guns. It was one of 16 communities in Illinois to restrict firearms, and passed an assault weapons ban following another mass shooting at
Right.
Sandy Hook. So this was, I mean, as a community, you saw this coming. And still, I mean, but that shows how pervasive it is.
Absolutely. And so, in the aftermath of Sandy Hook, interestingly, the state of Illinois gave us that opportunity. It was a 10-day window in the concealed carry law that allowed home rule municipalities to ban assault weapons. You had to take action within 10 days of that law being enacted, sort of a clear reflection of the sausage making of legislation in Springfield. But current Lake County Commissioner, then City Council member Paul Frank, highlighted this for us. And we said, this absolutely reflects our values. How could you, 6 months post Sandy Hook, as a parent, as a human being, not feel like if there's an opportunity to do something to mitigate assault weapon violence, you had to take that opportunity. So we talked for about 30 seconds. Somebody said, what if we get sued by the NRA? And we all said, we still need to do this. And they argued back, but we're a small city, we don't have the money. And we said, but we still need to do this. You have to take those opportunities. We weren't being blithe, we weren't being, dismissive. We just felt so strongly that we needed to take that action. And as you know, we did get sued through the Illinois arm of the NRA, and we went all the way to essentially the Supreme Court. The Seventh Circuit allowed our law to prevail. The Supreme Court decided not to hear the case, but that essentially said in the Seventh Circuit, this law is deemed constitutional. And we immediately went to work and started to contact the Illinois General Assembly and said, can you change the law? The Seventh Circuit has now said it's okay to ban assault weapons. We need to allow other communities to have this opportunity. Nobody responded. At some point, Kwame Raoul, who was then senator and chair of the Judiciary Committee for the Senate, invited me to come speak to that committee. I don't think it got out of committee, but it never made it to the floor when I said in 2018, I believe it was, you can take away this limit, this state preemption. You can allow other communities to ban assault weapons, or better yet, why not ban them as a state? And again, that kind of went nowhere. Fast forward, heaven help us, to May of 2022, and the Uvalde shooting happened. And I called my senator, and we decided I would write a letter to then Governor J.B. Pritzker and the Senate President Don Harmon and the Speaker of the House, Chris Welch. And I said to them, we've been talking about this now for almost 10 years. Can the state consider a ban on assault weapons? Or can we at least give other communities this right to ban assault weapons? And I didn't hear anything. And then 6 weeks later, the shooting happened in Highland Park. And I had a copy of that letter on my phone. And when the governor came to bring his condolences and to show his support for our community, I said, while you're here, I need to show you something that I sent you 6 weeks ago. Will you consider this ban? The statewide ban on assault weapons. And thankfully, our state rep, Bob Morgan, and our state senator, Julie Morrison, were able to move that legislation forward. And the state of Illinois in 2023 passed a statewide assault weapons ban. So far, they've been able to withstand all of the judicial challenges that people have tried to throw at them. But we're not an island, and we're surrounded by states that have ridiculously lax gun laws. And so we know that the vast majority of guns used primarily in Chicago shootings with regularity are coming from Indiana, Mississippi, Missouri. It's incumbent upon this country to pass, again, a federal assault weapons ban. There was one in 1994. It ran until 2004. During that time, according again to the Giffords organization, mass shooting related deaths dropped by 70%. And there's a call for this. The vast majority of Americans support banning these weapons because they know that weapons designed to kill as many people as fast as possible have no place in the hands of civilians. So that's where I think we need to be headed. Obviously, we have this balance with the Second Amendment. But let's be honest, folks. If you can't hit the deer that you're hunting with a regular sports gun, then maybe you should take up fishing. I believe that's what Senator Durbin has said with regularity. But you know, our peer nations don't allow people to have these guns without very clear psychological background checks, very clear training, very strict requirements on when these guns can be used. And I think we as a nation deserve better. I think our kids deserve better. It's a matter of public safety and public health and quality of life.
You're doing my job for me because though I was going to ask you questions that were leading right to this point, so thank you for that. Which means I now, but since we're on federal issues, let's move over to because so many things are happening in Washington. So many attempts are being made to cut funding. Federal funding for programs at local levels. Are you seeing any trimming of federal programs and funds that directly affect Highland Park?
Craig, I'd like to speak more generally. I'm currently the chair of the Metropolitan Mayor's Caucus, which represents Chicago and the 274 cities around Chicago. The very first impact that we felt as a caucus was, I think, within the first week when previously appropriated dollars, over $14 million from Congress to help with the build out of EV charging infrastructure was just taken away with the swipe of a pen. And it had already been appropriated by Congress. Several of the cities in the Chicagoland area had already put in sort of baseline infrastructure work, had taken staff time, and then were told flat out, you're not getting the money. Sorry. Sorry that you spent tax dollars to prepare. You're not getting the money. Now, as we move forward with putting together our budgets, we know the state is in the process of putting together its budget. That clearly has a ripple effect on municipalities. And everybody is so thrown off, not just by these cuts, but by the uncertainty. It's virtually impossible right now. It almost feels kind of like we're back during the pandemic when it was like, what will the costs be? Where are the funds coming from? What are the impacts on the economy? So many of us work to develop strong local economies to have sales tax revenue, offset some of the property taxes. It is really a game of what's behind door number one, two, and three.
And I'm going to let you keep your hat on as chair of the Municipal Mayor's Caucus. And by the way, for people wondering, Brandon Johnson is a vice chair on that board. And I also know you're on the board of the Chicago Metropolitan Agency on Planning. Well, in both of those things, mass transit has to be an issue. And the question is, are we going to see more funding for mass transit as they face the euphemism that we love to use these days, the fiscal cliff? And has the Mayor's Caucus or CMAP taken a position on what kind of structure we may should see for our mass transit agencies that admittedly aren't doing as well as they should?
Well, CMAP, for those who don't know what CMAP is, it's a regional government planning agency. It represents seven counties, 284 municipalities, about 8.5 million people. And they work on development and they work on transportation for Northeastern Illinois. They put together a really beautiful comprehensive plan that was sent to the Illinois General Assembly several months ago that had a lot of recommendations around what needs to happen in terms of mass transit. There are basically two issues. One is the governance and one is the funding. Illinois, interestingly, is one of the smallest donors, better word, funders of mass transit in the country. When you think about New York or Los Angeles or Boston, their states are providing significantly more dollars to fund their mass transit. And when you look at what we're talking about, it's the CTA, PACE, METRA, and then the RTA sort of overarching all of those entities. There's a real tension right now because the CTA is dealing with a lot of financial challenges, obviously impacts all of the people in Chicago and the environs, but PACE and METRA also are needing significant dollars. My seat on CMAP is to represent the County of Lake. I represent Lake County, which has significant, excuse me, significant transit deserts. And so the impact of those transit deserts isn't just it's hard to get around, you need a car, people can't afford cars. Here's a horrible example. During the pandemic, if you needed to use public transit to get to where COVID testing and COVID shots were, it would take over 2 hours from Highland Park in the dead of winter, including a half-hour walk. That's a horrible way for people to be getting around a community. And so there's a real need to coordinate across all of these entities. There's a real need to improve the funding. Metra, when it wants to improve its rolling stock, takes the cast-offs from New Jersey and Philadelphia and other train systems, trains that they have said are too old to run. We take them to make our rolling stock younger. So that should tell you how far behind we are in terms of improving both the trains, improving the tracks, dealing with the bridges that they all need to run on, making sure we have enough buses and buses that aren't polluting, more climate-friendly buses, drivers for the buses. I could go on for days. There's so much that goes into transit that's critical, not just for people to get around, but to improve their quality of life, to get people to school, to get people to the doctor, to get people to work. I've had conversations at the Waukegan Metro train station with folks who've already taken a 45-minute bus ride to get to their train, to get into the city, to get to their job, and then they have to do that in reverse. There's a lot more coordination that could come. I'm a University of Chicago grad. I love efficiencies, but I also recognize that we need to have all the voices representing the diverse communities around this Chicago region on that board that's making those decisions.
Well, thank you for that. And that's going to be the last word here for that. I want to thank Mayor Nancy Rotering of Highland Park for spending the half hour with us. To our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website. That's WBBMNewsRadio.com. There's a link on the homepage, and you can also find our podcast on Odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Dellamore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.